It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
And who shall separate the dust, which later we shall be? Whose keen discerning eye will scan and solve the mystery? The high, the low, the rich, the poor, the black, the white, the red, and all the chromatic between, of whom shall it be said? Here lies the dust of Africa, and here the sons of Rome. Here lies one unlabeled, the world at large his home. Can one then separate the dust? Will mankind lie apart? When life has settled back again, the same as from the start. Common Dust by Georgia Douglas Johnson. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is the second in our three-part series on the humanities and its contribution to culture in the United States. In the first session, we talked about the history and nature of the humanities, how it became institutionalized, and how it helped define the identity of our country. This morning, we're talking about the crisis in the humanities at the university level and in our national identity. My guests for this session are Adam Wood, a professor in the English department at Salisbury University, James King, also a member of the Salisbury faculty in the English department. James is developing the African Studies program for the university. Kara French is a professor of history and the director of the Gender Studies program. Welcome to all of you to Delmarva Today.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks to all of you for joining me. I really greatly appreciate it. Adam, let me begin with you. Remind us of what the humanities are and how this canon of work has come to help define our national identity.
Yep. Thank you again for having us, Hal. I think a great way to sort of start this is there's a definition from the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities and the Act that was passed in 1965 for that. And so that definition is the term humanities includes, but is not limited to, the study and interpretation of the following: language, both modern and classical, linguistics, literature, history, jurisprudence, philosophy, archaeology, comparative religion, ethics, the history, criticism, and theory of the arts, those aspects of social sciences which have humanistic content and employ humanistic methods, and the study and application of the humanities to the human environment with particular attention to reflecting our diverse heritage, tradition, and histories, and to the relevance of the humanities to the current conditions of national life. And I think this is a kind of an interesting one because it does sort of focus on the idea of a specifically American notion of the humanities. But I think it's also interesting that given that this definition was coined in 1965, that even though it talks about paying particular attention to reflecting our diverse heritage, the study of the humanities and indeed a lot of the humanities that we would see in popular culture in 1965 were predominantly white male humanities. And so that even though this definition attempts to have sort of this broad covering all of America sort of sense of things, when we think about 1965, you know, the humanities really did not reflect that actual diverse heritage, tradition, and histories. And so, you know, it's interesting that when we think about sort of the turmoil of the 1960s, that we began to see a pretty radical shift in the humanities. And I, in some ways, would like to kick it to Kara and James here, that two of the big areas that we saw sort of being developed in the 1960s in relation to the humanities were women's studies and ethnic studies, predominantly African studies in the 1960s. But again, I'm wondering if Kara and James could perhaps speak to perhaps the development of each one of those sort of fields of study within the humanities.
Can I I jump in for just a moment, Adam? Because in looking at this in the 1950s, it seemed to me, and you can respond to this, Kara and James, it seems to me that the humanities you're talking about up to then was basically a reflection of Western culture and Western and Western thought, Western society, because to a great degree we saw ourselves as of a Western culture. But now my point for Kara and James is that rather than including, and please both of you correct me on this, because I think this is an important point, rather than including them in the canon, women's studies and African-American literature impose themselves in the culture. I mean, their voices were inserted by themselves in the culture. It wasn't that, correct me, please. I don't believe it was that a great invitation was extended to James Baldwin, right, to Ralph Ellison, and to others to be included in the canon. They inserted their voices. And if I'm correct there, I think that's a very important point. So Kara and James, please. I think James would
agree with me on this, that you can't separate out the formation of women's and gender studies programs and a new focus in the humanity on women and a new focus in the humanity on ethnic studies and Africana studies from the activism of the 60s and 70s, that these programs were born of activism, sort of what you're saying, Harold, about inserting themselves and not waiting to be invited to the dance. Students held sit-ins in order to get these classes formed. I was just doing a little reading before our program today about the formation of the first women's studies program at San Diego State University. And the students held sit-ins. There were renegade classes being taught by faculty without pay, without compensation after hours. So this was a real movement, part of that larger New Left student-directed political movement of the 1960s, to not let, I guess, you know, the mostly the white men that were the gatekeepers of education at this time dictate what the curriculum was, to have students seize control of the curriculum and to demand a curriculum that more accurately reflected the diversity of America. Right, and the diversity of people attending college at this time.
James?
I agree absolutely with Kara's position in regards to this. That the thing that I would add has to do with what Adam said initially with regard to the legislation from 1965. That was more of a promise. Mm-hmm. That's a promissory note in my mind. And yes, were situations such at that 1965 moment that people were indeed being included in the ways that they should be? Absolutely not. But the legislation provided the opening. That's the foot in the door, right? At least that's the way that I look at it. That's the way that I see it in terms of how things move forward. And the other thing is that we really give our Constitution and the documents of this country, really, we give them short shrift, and we're ready to talk about tossing things. There is a lot of good genius that was incorporated into how this, you know, the flexibility that's engaged, the options that we can employ if we know the law, right, and if we know our constitutional rights, that they're all in there. I mean, that's a part of it, and I am not a in the system sort of person. I'm pretty far left of the system, if you want to ask. But looking at the system from that objective, as Du Bois would say, from above the veil, you know, there's a lot of good that went into it. And like you said, Dr. Wood, that document from 65, that legislation, again, I see it as a promissory note that can be acted upon by future generations who say, okay, now we have the legal right and entitlement to do this. You can't deny us. And you need that sort of backup. Sit-ins alone are not enough because you can just put people in jail for that. I was thinking about the folks at Indiana University when I was there as an undergrad. Stories were told about a dorm that I lived in that decided to shut itself off from the rest of Indiana University. Well, they tried to do this with different methods and so on until the university cut off water and power. And suddenly there was no more discussion. And so without the law to back up that unction, that gutsy action that puts people in the streets, that put people at Columbia University and at the California State Universities that protested until Black studies, Africana studies, African American studies, gender studies were a part of curriculums. It was a pairing in my mind that made these things happen, at least to the level that they have, that it places Dr. French and I and Dr. Wood right here today.
Well, James, the university was, and Kara, you've already mentioned it, Kara, the marches, but the university was really responding to what was happening in the streets, weren't they? And responding to what the students were doing.
A sense of solidarity among student groups, a sense of a collective organized spirit. I don't see it today, and that's very sad. It breaks my heart, but that's what was present. Then my wife grew up was a hippie in the 70s in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And she talks with great pride about protest march and about rallies and about being a 17, 16, 17, 18 year old who knew she was making a difference, but not putting her life on the line and being crazy dramatic, but knew by standing up for something, by having the gumption to take a stand, that was the right thing to do. And that spirit of the 60s is to a great extent, it's been diffused today. I find it hard to locate in any quantity. When I was going to Gulf War marches for the Gulf One and Gulf Two marches, I found the speakers more focused on their individual agendas than the men and women who were losing their lives over in these useless military battles. People would say everything about their particular agenda or point of view and then end it with no blood for oil. And it was just really sort of hollow. And so where we find that solidarity, where I can find Kara and folks in the areas where she's got her heart committed, willing to join up arm in arm with me, I don't know how that happens anymore. In part because universities and cities don't want to. How can you protest? How can you march when you can't get farther than a city block before you've got barricades and things that obstruct you?
Well, I wanted to mention Louis Manon's article in the March 22nd New Yorker, and in which he talks about that era, James, which actually was my era. I was in the streets at that mm-hmm. time, both the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. The 60s were my years in that respect. And in the sense of what you're saying, one of the things that Manon says in his article, which is actually on the New Left and the New Left of the 1960s, and whether mm-hmm. the New Left has anything to say to us today? Can we learn anything from them? And one of Manon's comments is that, and you've hit on this, the students involved had experienced a feeling of personal liberation through group solidarity. A largely illusory, Manon says, but genuinely moving sense that the world was turning under their marching feet. And by God, we did feel that way. We felt like we were doing something. Manon goes on, it was the sense that your words and actions matter, that you matter. This is what inspires people to take risks and give movements there for change their momentum. And what I hear you saying is that that spirit is lacking somewhat, even though I do see it out there today.
I would push back a little on what James has said. And I think it might be because history and hindsight are 2020, and we can't quite tell what the after effects are going to be. But certainly the Black Lives Matter protest movements over the summer, and even some movements by students on our own campus to push for programs like Africana Studies in a more inclusive curriculum, I do see some of that coming back. You know, in feminist circles, right, there has been critiques of hashtag activism or slacktivism, of people just kind of sitting back and hitting reblog rather than being willing to take to the streets and being willing to march. But I think maybe what we're seeing now is a merger of some of that online activism, like the Me Too movement, actually, you know, translating or Black Lives Matter as a hashtag, actually translating into more sustained protest movements. But we can't quite tell yet whether or not this is going to be a sustained movement and affect social change, or if this was just a moment that has passed and that is not going to be able to make those substantive changes the way the movements of the 60s and 70s did.
Well, let me come back to the humanities, mm-hmm. and the voices in the humanities. And very clearly, we know, and to some degree, we're part of the voices of the humanities. And they were significant. They were significant voices. Manon says that they got swallowed up by the Vietnam War, the self-immolation, he calls it, of the Vietnam War, and then the chaos, the political chaos and so forth that came after that. But let me ask you, who, if they were the voices of the 60s, if I was one of the voices of the 60s, as an example, who are the new voices? Who are the voices in the humanities today that come out of the diversity now of literature that I argue inserted itself in the 60s and made us pay attention to the diversity of cultures? So Adam, why don't you jump in here and...
Well, I mean, it's interesting if we think about the sort of current moment that we're in now. I was thinking when James and Kara were talking that, you know, we think about the sort of erupting in the 1960s, and that we've seen moments where it seems to recede for a little bit and then it sort of rises back up. So, you know, obviously when it sort of starts, we have sort of Nixon in the White House. Then we think sort of the second round of the culture wars that people talk about in the 1980s and sort of the Reagan 80s. And some people are saying that this is a third or a fourth sort of iteration of it. One of the things that I think is interesting and perhaps even more challenging now is, you know, given the sort of digital age that we work in, the idea of seminal texts, you know, if we think sort of, Betty Friedman's text, for example, you know, sort of that captured sort of national attention, that I'm wondering if there is a challenge in the sort of contemporary moment in that we have, on the one hand, a sort of explosion of voices, but also perhaps an over proliferation, so that there are not in the same way sort of seminal texts coming out of the humanities that have the sort of singular impact that some of the texts in the 60s might have had. At the same time, I think there are certain names we're seeing come up more and more often that are emerging out of these sort of area studies, to use the sort of broad term, but they often are much more, I think, sort of just directly about politics and less about the humanities. I'm thinking of someone like Ibram X. Kendi, right, who is sort of very, very large on the scene, but his connection to the humanities is fairly thin, even though his sort of the ideas that he is working with emerged out of the humanities, but he himself doesn't seem terribly interested in literature, for example, or I mean, I guess he has training in history, but again, he's much more interested in sort of the contemporary political moment. But that may just be sort of my vantage point on sort of seminal texts at the moment.
Seems to me like someone like that, Adam, that you're describing is a part of the dispersal, post-humanities almost, then, rather than being in the midst of it. And I was thinking more about the way that our media choices, our ways of ingesting information have been modified, whatever we want to call it, such that the graduate course I took on how to publish your book as a grad, you know, as someone, you know, you're putting something into LFQ or whatever, you know, galley proofs, you remember all that sort of foolishness and all of that. That's not the pathway anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not even exclusively just a digital pathway with PDFs or whatever. There are so many different ways now for people to introduce their thoughts. And it's so much so that it's not so much about seminal text anymore as it is hopefully about seminal thoughts, about individuals coming up with ideas, groups of individuals, you know, sort of signing on, signifying on those ideas, and then moving forward to pair those ideas with positive action, you know, that helps communities, that feeds people, that addresses disease, but ideas rather than sort of, I mean, what's a text look like anymore? How many, you know, Dr. French in your class, what it used to be when you assign a text, it would be a certain size, you could put it in a backpack, but now what's that text look like?
Yeah, no, it could be a podcast, it could be a digital museum exhibit, it could be a documentary film, it could be, you know, an online archive of some kind, but I agree that texts are becoming more diverse, and that, you know, it is a more multivocal movement. And when, you know, from the feminist perspective, we often talk about third wave feminism, sort of the feminism in the 90s and into the early 2000s. You know, it's questionable if it's a third wave today or a new fourth wave. We're always debating the waves, but it's specifically multivocal, that it's not about a universalizing female experience, which it was in the 60s and 70s, which might have brought unity in some ways, but often left people with more diverse identities left out. You know, color feminists, queer feminists, working class feminists sometimes felt marginalized in those discussions. So I think, especially for people coming from a feminist perspective right now in the humanities, intersectionality is such an important concept. This idea that, you know, different types of oppressions create one another, that you can't separate out race from gender, from sexual orientation. If you find yourself as, you know, someone as a Black lesbian feminist, or you just cannot take those things apart because your experiences of race and gender create each other. And it might be hard to find that unifying, universalizing concept, but I think it's a more authentic coming together and a more authentic understanding of identity when we recognize people's diversities and diverse positions.
Kara, let me ask you, who are the voices of this new feminist movement that you mentioned? What is it, the third or the fourth wave?
The third or the fourth wave? You know, I mentioned intersectionality. I mean, this is a text from the 90s, Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, who was a Black academic and advocate. I think somebody like Susan Stryker, who is a transgender historian and is writing transgender history and talking about identity that way. You know, I think even the Me Too movement itself and people trying to make that sort of sexual harassment, make that more clear and to organize around these incidents of sexual violence. And that's not a one person driving that movement. That's a collective, collective movement.
James, who are the new Black voices and what are they telling us?
I think some of the new Black voices are still the old Black voices. Brother Cornel West is out there, you know, doing it, trying to keep it real. And you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates would be an individual to listen did a course on his material with a class full of young Baltimoreans who just ate it up. And what they loved about him was the connection, the connection to their world, to their lives, and it wasn't so distant. And let me throw in here before we start talking more about, because what we're trying to do here is build a canon, and I don't know if I want to participate in that. But let me say this: props to Luke Manan, right, a grad CUNY grad center guy, along with Michelle Wallace and Bell Hooks, all there during the time that I was there as a student. And what this whole conversation about the humanities brings to my mind are those little mini lectures, or whatever we would call them, that they had on Fridays. You know, and I was getting my student aid money by serving wine and cheese, while Ross Posnock talked about cosmopolitanism, and while Luke Manan read chapters to the book that got him yanked from CUNY over to Harvard. He became this new and up-and-coming star in 2003. And so the academy itself, the university, should be a location for that revivification, or for that sustaining of the humanities. I know it seems somewhat ironic since that's what we teach, but we've also got to preach it, if you understand me. We've got to put it in public forums. We've got to bring public intellectuals from all areas and all aspects of life, bring them in, have them talk to kids. I'm doing a book right now, and one of the things that makes it work for me is the fact that I heard the gentleman lecture on the book in the movie back in 1978. When you have a chance to sit down post-COVID, and you know, or even mid-COVID, all of the different ways. My former colleague Robert Smith is talking about how theater has found ways to live in Zoom, right? Where people are able to act and do things with the continuity that one would find on the stage. But we can create those sorts of spaces where we reinvigorate, we bring students' interest. They find out what feminism is, first, second, third, fourth wave, by coming to hear you speak, Dr. French, and the people that you bring in that have the information that inspired you. And then the university becomes that shining light on a hill, not of ideologies and ideologues, but of a range of different ways that people can view and understand the world.
Adam, in your studies and in your work, who are the voices that you are resonating to and that you want your students to listen to?
You know, it's interesting. I think sort of along with what James was saying, I think one of the complications now is the idea, you know, the classic idea was that there was a canon of texts that we looked at, right? So in literature, there were the certain texts that were deemed better than the others that we looked at, right? I'd imagine even history, there were certain historical documents that were sort of deemed, well, these are far more important. That we live in the era now of sort of a proliferation, right? And that the idea of sort of, you know, simplifying it down to this handful of texts becomes more and more complicated, particularly when the ideas that we had classically used to assign the greatest text were sort of prone to be a bit problematic, right? And again, I think this is one of the things that perhaps James was kind of hinting at, that the idea of sort of deciding, well, here are the singular texts that are super important to us now, is really in contradiction with the times, where the idea of this sort of notion of proliferation, you know, you think a simple example is something like music, right? Where it used to be that you would either hear what was on the radio or you would have to go and purchase something, where now you can hear any amateur anywhere. You know, we've got the technology, they can put this stuff out there. Is a lot of it perhaps not as high quality as others? It certainly is, but at the same time, we have to sort of understand that that is also an historical document in and of itself. And again, I think to what Kara was sort of saying, the idea that we have opportunities to hear more voices now than we ever have before is in some ways what's really liberating. The flip side I would say to this is that, do we run the risk of the humanities no longer having some sort of center, right? If it's just, well, we, you know, and this was the problem with the very term text, right? So we think literary theory, you know, coming out of the 60s was everything was a text, which on the one hand was liberating, but you extend that so far that you have people sort of doing studies of what some people would view as fairly flippant sort of things and deciding, well, you know, that is as important as this. Hal and I had a conversation once before, and I was telling him that for a period of time, Buffy the Vampire Slayer studies was a really hot sort of thing. And everybody was sort of talking about that. And you do have to ask the question at some point, what is it that people who study the humanities are spending their time on? And that's not to say that there's nothing valuable that can come out of studying Buffy, but it's a totally different thing than the old model, which is go to the classic text, right? Go to these texts that everyone has sort of agreed on. Does, and I guess I would pose this in some way to James and Kara with what they were saying, does it complicate, you know, things that Kara had said was that there's no longer a unified sense of the humanities. Is that one of the challenges that we're facing now, though, as a discipline as a whole, that when people say, what do you do? And we kind of throw our hands up and we go, we do all of it. Is that in some ways complicating the notion of people looking at the humanities as a set of things?
Well, let me.
You always interrupt my questions.
I know, because you always give me some different or new idea to build off of that. And what I wanted to ask all of you is, as a student of the humanities in the late 1950s, and I was going to say the 1960s, but frankly, it was all over at the end of the 1950s. It seemed to me that the humanities had the purpose of indoctrinating me into some kind of basic Western culture, Western ethics, Western values, Western ideas, and Western identity. Because as a student in a Southern university in the 1950s, I didn't even know that there were universities that had other cultural approaches to them. So my question is this, if I'm anywhere near being correct, that this was kind of the purpose of the humanities, was this indoctrination of Western culture and values and so forth. And I'm probably well overstating, but nonetheless, that's what I felt. With Adam, the center, I would say that was the center. Pieces that were chosen were part of that indoctrinary approach. If there's at any accuracy at all to that, what is the center of this new approach to the humanities? You say that it is becoming so diverse that there may not be a center. So what are the humanities trying to say today in the midst of this very conscious, very aware, diverse culture that we're living in today?
Yeah, I mean, just to start out, I mean, I would say I think that you're right, that before the 60s, before we saw these sort of radical changes, the idea of what the canon was, of what the humanities were fairly well set, but they were also, there was a large fence up around it, right? That it was not as fluid of a thing as it perhaps wanted to express itself as, that it was very much about gatekeeping, right? And so again, you know, is Shakespeare, you know, the greatest writer of all time? Well, that's a really interesting question, but for the longest time, it was just sort of stated that that was the fact, right? That there was not really much debating that. And even the interpretations of Shakespeare for the longest time were typically, fairly innocuous. Let's just look how Shakespeare tells us something about his time period. Where even when we think about those classic texts, you know, something like Shakespeare, one of the things that we saw coming up in the 1960s were radical rereadings of Shakespeare, right? Rereadings of female characters in Shakespeare, of Black characters in Shakespeare, of different sort of attempts of reading Shakespeare that were really going against the grain, right? That was sort of a phrase that was very popular in the 60s and 70s, the idea of reading against the grain. And so it's interesting that we've not abandoned all those texts, but not only added more on top of them, but thought of new ways of looking at the kinds of information the older humanities passed along, which at times are perhaps very, very problematic, right? One of the challenges, I think, is that, you know, you have some people who want to do away with the old humanities. Oh, those were racist, those were sexist, those were whatever they were. That doesn't accord to our sort of tastes of the time. But I think, you know, the scholars that are really doing the more productive work are really sort of reinterrogating those classic texts, right? Looking to see, are there still messages in those texts that we can carry forward, right? That it's not an entirely sort of destructive atmosphere, even though that is often the easy target, right? One of the big attacks on the humanities these days is that, oh, they just want to tear everything down, which I think is sort of a misrepresentation.
It would be easy. It would be easy then, following Adam's lead, to teach a text like Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but not teach it as a canonical text, teach it rather from the vantage point of our departed brother Chinua Achebe, who described Conrad as a, quote, bloody racist. And so you can still engage the classical text, you can still engage the canon, but you can interrogate the canon with different lenses, and with lenses that are new and that are evolving based upon the constituencies and the populations that are new and evolving. Don't know what a queer reading of certain Shakespearean texts would look like in this current historical moment. But we never will, except the humanities is allowed to continue to evolve and to allow for that sort of experimentation. That's why I get really frustrated when I hear about things, censorship, for instance, in drama that takes place. Different ways that artistic vision and are hindered for the sake of donors or things. And I get it. It takes money to run a university, but it also takes ingenuity. It takes spirit. It takes all these other intangibles along with those credentials that you have to have room for. And maybe that's, I'm sorry if that's not particularly articulate, but maybe that's one of the things that humanity provides a space for, is for the sort of discovery and the creation of the self. Help me, Lord Jesus.
Yeah, to echo that, I would say for me, I mean, the humanities is less about a canon than a series of methods, right? Methods that the different humanities bring that focus on the human experience, that focus on the close reading and close examination of texts, that focus on critical thinking, and, you know, whether that's philosophy or history, reading historical documents, trying to synthesize information, to make judgment calls, to understand what you don't know about a given text, or literature, to really get into text, whatever that is, and to look at it closely and to spend some time with it and reflect upon it. And one thing that we haven't gotten into is that since the 1960s, there's been an incredible amount of interdisciplinarity, I think, in the humanities and cross-pollination between English and literature, especially, and history. Historians call it the cultural turn or the linguistic turn, where we really started taking cultural texts seriously as documents or cultural artifacts, if you want to call it that way, rather than just always looking at demographics or looking at political texts, really, understanding that popular culture has a history. It's funny, in English literature, they call it the historical turn, where they start more closely examining the historical production around Heart of Darkness or around different Shakespearean texts. So they're kind of mirror images of each other, but they're not the same.
I think the sense, James, you mentioned it, the sense of perspective that you come to a piece of literature, a piece of art, with a different perspective. And to give you a personal example of that, the big turning point for me, as an example, a student of the 50s, a kid of the 50s, was reading Camus. And after reading Camus and reading Sartre, then I came to Conrad's Heart of Darkness. You never look at the Heart of Darkness the same. again. And it was what the humanities in that sense did was it shifted perspective so that now you see things differently. You see the same old text and you say, oh my God, why didn't I see this before? And so, Kara, in your gender studies program, in terms of perspective, what do you want your students to come out with relative, how do you want them to look at the world? Do you want them to look at the world differently? And then James, the same for you with your African studies program. Kara?
I think having them come out with a better sense of how ideas about gender and sexuality act in everyday life, and some of them choose a more, it is an interdisciplinary program, some of them choose a more historical focus, and so they can see the origins of these ideas and how gender and sexuality as concepts, just like anything else, they change over time. They're not static, they're the product of a given society at a given moment in time, but just to have a greater awareness of that, and so that they're conscious and aware of how, you know, ideas about gender and ideas about sexuality are all around them, and also because of that tight connection with activism, you know, an awareness of how activists have tried to push at those boundaries and tried to change our ideas, try to challenge sexual stereotypes over time, hopefully an empowerment to make them feel like they can make a difference too.
James?
Yeah, I focus on in Africana studies and Africana versus African insofar as it addresses the dispersal of African peoples, not just those individuals on the African continent. The focus there, if I can say there is one, is just to enlighten our students to the existence of the African continent, for starters. No disrespect to history. You guys are doing yeoman's work, but we still have a large part of our population that can't point out major countries on a map that are right. Part of the African continent. And again, that's not a historian's fault. That's a matter of a lack of focus, a genuine disinterest in that part of the world that the university and that the humanity still has to come to a reckoning with. It's not called terra incognita for nothing. Another focus of Africana studies will be to show the areas of commonality, the areas of connection, the lines of connectivity, the sort of the etymological points. You know, so this is your history. This is the birth line, if you will, of these other different ideas and how, not that it all emanates from the African continent, that's not the point of it, but to show where there are those points of connection. And then finally, to begin to reckon with individuals on the African continent as members of the real world, as we call it, instead of constantly relegating those individuals to, you know, the language of a developing nation at best or a third world country at worst. Collaboration with colleges and universities, for instance, in Ghana, we've got memorandum of understanding already in place, so we can send students there, we can send faculty there, they can do the same, they can send those individuals here. A robust and healthy post-COVID study abroad and student exchange and faculty exchange program is very much what this Africana study major is about. It's a 10-course major. I'm not here to plug that, but to talk about the focus of it. Sorry, I get a little carried away.
So yeah. In a sentence, James, how do you want the perspective on the world of your students to change as a result of taking your courses? What do you want them to see differently?
I want them to see not the ubiquitous, but the infinitely intricate connectivity between people in the world that makes us far more alike one another than different from one another. James Baldwin said it, and if the gay man can be sexist, okay. He said, we're all brothers. Yeah. If you can't get past that, you can't get past anything else.
Right.
And so I want this major, I want the work that takes place in the major to speak to the connections that can be had between people who's come reflections are as different as mine is from everyone else on this screen. And those experiences that good for good and for bad vary because of that difference in complexion and gender or gender selection, whatever the language may choose to be. If you can find ways to bridge that, that's what a good major does. That's what a good program does. And the scholarship that comes out of it, the ability for kids to publish and to become those scholars for the next generation, that's all just gravy. But getting the connection first so that we understand that we all need one another and that we have far more in common than we have not in common. That's the reason for a major like Africa.
Adam, how about your work? How do you want the perspective, or let me state it a little differently. How would you like for the worldview of your students to change as a result of your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about this in terms of teaching in the classroom. And again, you know, one of the things that I teach more often than anything is the American novel. Is sort of my wheelhouse. And one of the things that I really strive to do, I think, is not to try to have students view the world a particular way when they finish my class, but to view the world in different ways with each one of the novels that they're looking at, right? And the most effective way to do that is to provide as many different novelistic voices as possible. So if an average undergraduate course, I can cover 8 novels in a semester, to try to make sure that minority voices are represented, that women's voices are represented, that queer voices are represented, and to really try to expose students, as James was just really sort of stressing, to the threads that do tie us together despite what seem to be very disparate identities and existences. If we have lost the old sense of the humanities as this singular unifying voice that holds us together, and I think, you know, James and Kara were both sort of hinting at this, that perhaps the project for the humanities now is sort of threading these different existences together in some way, right? That there are these sort of shared experiences. I think one of the things that the humanities has struggled with recently is that there are some scholars, and they seem to suck the air out of the room, who don't seem to be intent on sort of bringing different voices together as much as just sort of, no, this is only this, you know, this is the new way we're going to interpret everything. That is not that sort of pluralistic openness it purports to be. But I think that genuine, in some ways, the promise of the humanities, to go back to the language that James was really keying in on in that definition, the promise of the humanities is perhaps in some ways to show us that we can recognize ourselves in the radical other, right? That it's one thing to see ourselves in people who are somewhat like us, racially, gender, whatever it is, but it's another thing to see ourselves in someone as different as they can possibly be. And that the humanities has the potential, at least, to make those connections, right? To allow us to sort of see the face of the other, for lack of a better term, in a very radical new sort of way, right?
When my white students understand double consciousness and understand what Du Bois was talking about in 1903, that two-ness of self, you know, that struggle within the African-American body, when my white students can write about that and articulate an understanding of it that I would put out on the street to any scholar, that's what the humanities can do. It doesn't make them any better than the African-American student. It adds a certain degree of parity to the world so that brother to brother, they understand one another in a way that they didn't before. And that is something that I constantly see in student evaluations, commentary. I'll get emails from students from years ago. Adam, this happens to you. Kara, I know it does too, where folks will say, you know what, there's a text that you exposed me to when I was in such and such a class. And now here I am, you know, 5, 7, 10 years later on a job, something or other, and something that you taught me, something that you exposed me to, helped me to do better in my area of work. Not because I'm an historian, but because that knowledge of the humanities that was something in that lecture you gave, in that novel that you shared, and in the way that you shared it, it has helped me in the world of work. I wish I had a nickel for all the times I got that. I'd be well on the way to paying off my student loans, you know, but it's not me, it's the material. Like I tell my students, we need to honor the material. And that's not laying down and putting my head in the sand, Robinson Crusoe style, like Friday, for somebody to put their foot on top of it. But it's, you know, game recognized game.
With the internet, you talked about earlier, Kara, the fact that information comes. The humanities are coming at people, not just from the university, but from all angles of our society today. And I have the bias that it is through the humanities, in that broadest perspective, that we come to define ourselves. We define ourselves as individuals, and there is a collective definition of who we are that emerges. So my question is, and we have a few minutes left, so my question is, James, back to the 1960s and the struggle of the 1960s, are we struggling today as a country to redefine ourselves? And is that part of what this rapid change in the nation's demographics is pressuring us to do as well?
Hal, I think that one of the things that's taking place, evidence of it, January 6th, is you've got a population that's in the decline of its ascendancy in terms of power and the ability to that was an individual effort to wrest control of the United States government by a group. We can't paint it no other way, you know. And those individuals represent folks who feel as if their country has been stolen from them. And so, Adam, bring me back. Where was I going with this?
Well, I think you were trying to sort of highlight the sense that, I think that we are, and we've seen this, I think, since the 1960s, again, this is what I was talking about, sort of the ebb and flows of the sort of culture wars, that the idea that, you know, even if we are still struggling to try to come up with a definition of a broader sense of America or something like that, that it is it's an extremely troubling process to go through, right? Again, the old humanities just sort of said, no, this is what it is, and you sort of went with that. Where I think since the 1960s, with that proliferation of voices, that insistence upon hearing these other voices, we're really having to constantly rework that sense of definition. And you're right, anytime you have
We need to broaden the ranks of the shepherds. That's the best language that I can use. My mentor from Ghana used it. He used to talk with me all the time, and he would say, son, you need a shepherd, somebody to lead you through. Right? It doesn't mean they know exactly every single way to do a thing. It doesn't mean that it's a man that's doing it. But like Kara, you lead your class. That's your class. You're its shepherd. And Carol? So expand that.
I don't know if this quite answers your question, Harold, but I'm a historian of 18th and 19th century America. And I keep thinking about how in early 19th century, you know, a college education was the humanities. And it was restricted. It was only up until the first bachelor's degrees weren't given to women or African Americans really until the 1840s. So it was restricted to white men only could have bachelor's degrees. And what they studied was classics, theology, history, rhetoric. And it was a very, very strict definition. To be a lawyer or a doctor was considered to be a tradesman. Right. An engineer was little more than a tinkerer. but it certainly that's a very restrictive definition of what the humanities would be today. But as we've broadened up, who can get a college education? More than 50% of college undergraduates today are women. Right. We have more people of color attending university than ever before. We have opened up the humanities, not nearly enough, but we have opened up the ranks of the shepherds. So the people that are leading educational experiences are not the people that were making up the academy in the 50s and 60s. And there is a desire to hold on to the now that that curriculum has become more diverse. I think people are devaluing it. Right.
I think you're right. And I would add to that, you know, I think that for the longest time, you know, even up until not too long ago, anytime you had someone who worked in the humanities who was on a news program, it was an old white guy in a tweed blazer, right? Who sort of seemed to hold forth as being the repository of
the elbow patches.
With the elbow patches, right? That had been passed down, where even the look of, you know, academics who are studying the humanities does not look like that anymore. No. And is increasingly looking less and less like that. And you can imagine in some ways that this has been a pretty radical shift, right? That for the longest time, people would think, well, let's look to the universities for an expert. And they, again, they were used to an old guy in a tweed jacket with elbow patches. And they have some expert on now. And, you know, as Kara mentioned sort of earlier, it's a radical Black lesbian feminist. And, you know, a lot of people look at that and just think, I don't understand what has happened. Where's the old guy in the tweed patches? And again, I think that we are in a really difficult moment of that right now, right? That the polarization that we've seen in the past 4 years has really simply heightened this to extremely dangerous levels. I'd like to say, I think the humanities is that thing that can pull us back to continue with that language, if we are effectively shepherding, if we are effectively threading together these different voices and showing that there are these commonalities, right? And out of those commonalities, perhaps we can arrive at sort of a new definition of what it is that is more all-encompassing. But again, that is, I think, the real challenge that the humanities is facing right now. And that the humanities is at times not doing its best at representing itself, I think, is one of the other challenges with that.
When you speak to that, when you look at the population of the shepherds, to push it one final step, at places, you know, like our institution, where I quote stat I'm constantly using is less than 1% of the African of the faculty, tenure track faculty, is African American. That may have grown some here recently, but when something starts at less than 1% out of 400 tenure track faculty, that's problematic. And so, and likewise with women and representation for other different groups that are a part. Best educator I ever worked for was at a magnet middle school, and he said that your teaching population and your student population should match the demographics of the community where the school can be located. I see that as just as good a logic as having cops live in the neighborhoods that they police and things like that, so that people understand one another. And that you don't go into a school and it's some new foreign place, you know, as many students of color experience and many students of different orientations experience when they come here to the lower, slower shore.
If you can't be it, if you can't see it, you can't be it, is what I often tell my students, right? They need to see a representative leadership, right, among their teachers, among the faculty, not so that they can necessarily enter the academy, some of them might, but so that they can see themselves as authoritative leaders.
And you're right, and I think it's important to point out how much slower universities have been, right? If we look, for example, at film directors, right, the diversification of film directors since the 1960s has moved at a much quicker pace than universities. And that, you know, I think that that's really one of the issues that continues to be really a problem, is that are humanity scholars keeping up with the cultural production? And that becomes, again, I think really one of the challenges that's being talked about here.
Keeping up with the cultural production, but also perhaps keeping up with the technological demand for trained personnel who can work with and understand and deal with that technology. The technology, it seems to me, we didn't talk about it to a great extent, but I think it's a huge elephant in the room in terms of the humanities, is the demands that technology is placing on us. And Kara, you mentioned it earlier, the fact that the humanities come to us from everywhere now. And Adam, the diffusion of the center. And those are fascinating concepts, I think, right now to be wrestled with. Well, Menon ends his piece in The New Yorker by saying the nation was at a crossroads in the 1960s. The system did not break, but it did bend. He says we are at another crossroads today. It can be made to bend again. Next month, we're going to do the last in this series on the humanities, and we'll talk about what that bend might look like. Thanks to Kara, James, Adam, for joining me today. A fascinating discussion, and I really, really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for listening. This is Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.